In dozens of countries, confidence in childhood vaccines has dropped. Tens of millions of kids have missed their shots. Misinformation is partly to blame.
When you're faced with this level of misinformation, it's a really tough job for families to pick through the information and work out what they can believe and what they can trust in.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Spanish police have busted the largest known cocaine lab ever seen in Europe. An operation, says its drug commissioner, capable of producing 500 pounds of cocaine a day. And it's only happening a few times a century. Today, a special kind of eclipse graced the southern skies. Oh! Oh! We'll also get the latest on the crisis in Sudan and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. We know childhood vaccines save lives, but in dozens of countries, confidence in them has dropped significantly since the start of the pandemic. That's according to a new report out today from UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund. In 55 countries studied, some 67 million kids have missed out on routine vaccines just in the past few years. UNICEF's Lily Caprani joins me from New York to break down these findings. Lily, which countries have seen the most significant decline in confidence in childhood vaccines?
Well, worryingly, the data that UNICEF is publishing today comes from a study across 55 different countries. And out of those 55, 52 showed that there was a decline in the number of people who were saying that they think it's really important to vaccinate children. And that's comparing before the pandemic and then in the 3 years afterwards. So that's really concerning because it's a widespread issue and it's affecting all parts of the world. There are a few exceptions. We've seen confidence in vaccination holding up in India, China and Mexico, but sadly really declining in many other places. And ironically, at the same time as we were going through a pandemic when I hope we've learned some lessons about the importance of protecting our communities and making sure they are immune to very infectious diseases.
So the headline here is that a large number of people in these 52 countries say, you know, vaccines are less important than they used to be. How does a decline in confidence then relate to vaccine uptake? Are changing attitudes causing vaccination rates to decline?
We definitely know that confidence in vaccines is the number one, that trust is the most important thing in vaccine acceptance. I mean, it's a lot of other things too, you know, making it convenient and easy for busy working parents to get their kids to the clinics also matters, especially if they have to take time out of work. You know, there's always practical things like that that can stand in the way of getting it done. But ultimately, without trust, we are not going to have a functioning public health system. You need to trust your healthcare worker and your provider, and you need to trust in the vaccines. And really that comes down to having trustworthy, reliable information that's based on facts. You know, the evidence shows vaccines like measles have been around for 60 years. They have saved millions of lives. Without the measles vaccines, we would be seeing thousands of children dying every year. That's the fact. Maybe memories are short and we've forgotten that. We've taken it a bit for granted that we're safe from these illnesses, but they're making a comeback and we can't let it happen.
The COVID-19 pandemic also exposed a lot of inequities in healthcare across the globe. In countries where vaccine confidence is low, how does a lack of resources, everything from money for research and development to salaries for frontline workers to health education access, how does that also play a role in declining vaccination rates?
Yeah, it's definitely true that you need a really well-resourced and resilient healthcare system to be able to get to all the children who need vaccines. It comes down to fundamentals like having enough healthcare workers who are trained and paid and have the resources that they need, and they can get hold of the supplies of the vaccines that they need. And in some of the poorer countries of the world, that's just not the case. We saw health systems, even in the richest countries of the world, stretch to their limit throughout the COVID pandemic. And it took an absolute whole society effort to overcome the acute phase of the pandemic. So you can imagine what it would be like in a country without those resources. So we need this to be a political priority, and the richer countries of the world to support poorer countries to build those health systems back up. The effect that these massive outbreaks have on whole communities and societies and even across borders is got to be the lesson that we take from the pandemic. Let's not have huge waves of more illnesses like measles, polio, diphtheria, killing children next.
Some big countries like China, India, and Mexico bucked the trend and actually saw an increase in vaccine confidence. Why is the opposite happening in those places? And does the increase in confidence imply an uptake in jabs in arms?
Whilst it's very concerning to see this decline in the number of people saying they think vaccinating children is important, but there are a few countries that buck the trend. And it shows it. It just goes to show that we can tackle this. We've got strategies. We know what works. In countries where it is considered a top priority, where there is the money there to go out and pay healthcare workers, to reach out into communities, to find the families, to give them the information and deliver the vaccines that they need, we can tackle the problem. We can try to reach as many children as possible. And in some countries, we're talking about well over 90% of children who get protected against all of those illnesses. So we know it's possible. We know it's doable. We know we can overcome these big public health emergencies when there's a real collective effort. But it's not happening in enough countries, and it's not happening fast enough. These children who missed out on measles and other essential vaccines are already getting to that age where they should have been protected by now, and they haven't been. And that means they're very vulnerable to catching these highly infectious diseases and spreading it around in their communities.
Interestingly, your report also found that women and people under 35 were more likely to lack confidence in vaccines. What have their experiences been?
Yeah, one of the most interesting and alarming findings in this new data is showing us that under 35s are the more likely to say that they don't think that vaccinating children is as important. And honestly, we were surprised to find that at UNICEF. That's not something we had previously found. It's new information, and we want to better understand what's driving that. We know that there are basically two different levels on which we can talk to communities about the safety and the efficacy of vaccines. One is in their communities with, you know, their peers, with their families, with their religious leaders, whoever they listen to and trust. On the other hand, there is a whole online world, and, you know, a small number of sources of misleading information can very quickly spread all over the world. And when you're faced with this level of misinformation, it's a really tough job for families to pick through the information and work out what they can believe and what they can trust in.
Finally, Lily, you began to talk about resurgence earlier, but I'm wondering whether there's a kind of tipping point with this low confidence trend where old diseases might become much more widespread again. What do you think?
Well, look, it's not all doom and gloom. We still have around 80%, on average, 80% of people will say, yeah, it's important to vaccinate children. It's still a good, healthy majority. But nonetheless, we are seeing that number go down, and we've seen it go down year on year. And that's a really worrying trend, which we must stop. We're already seeing the consequences of this disruption over the last 3 years. With 67 million children missing out on vaccines, we've also seen a surge in measles cases. Last year, 33 countries reported big disruptive measles outbreaks. We've seen a 16% increase in the number of children paralyzed by polio, an illness that we thought was yesterday's news, which is making a comeback. So these consequences are very real. They're already happening, and they're going to be measured in children's lives.
Lily Caprani is Senior Advisor for Advocacy at UNICEF, speaking about a new report that found child vaccination rates declining by up to 44% in some countries. Lily Caprani, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Sudan has rapidly descended into chaos. Just 6 days ago, most residents of the capital, Khartoum, were observing a quiet Ramadan. Now, battles rage in city centers, and millions of residents are hiding in their homes. Two rival generals are responsible for the violence. One is the commander of Sudan's armed forces. The other leads a powerful militia. Both sides have wealthy international backers. To help us understand the tangle of global alliances, we reached out to Cairo-based journalist Matt Nashed. I asked him who were the main backers of General Abdel Fattah Burhan, the leader of Sudan's armed forces.
His main backer would be Egypt, because Egypt has had long-standing relationships with the Sudanese military. They've had top security deals and cooperation. A number of generals in the past have trained with the Egyptian armed forces, even fought in the Yom Kippur War back in 1973. So Egypt is quite fundamentally behind Burhan and the Sudanese armed forces here.
Right. So for Egypt, there's that security interest in Sudan. The corollary, though, would Egypt be worried about a civilian-led government in neighboring Sudan?
Yes. Neither Egypt, nor I would say any other regional powers, are invested in civilian governance. They fear that if there's a successful example of democracy in one place, then people might believe that there could be a successful example of democracy in another.
In the rival camp, Mutt, who is providing support for General Mohamed Dagalo and his militia, the RSF?
He has longstanding ties with the United Arab Emirates, which also had parallel relations and business ties and conversations with the army as well. So we see alliances can be blurred in it.
In addition, we see that the Russian mercenary group Wagner is mining gold in Sudan. What can you tell us about their operations and how that might play into this conflict?
Wagner had a number of business relationships and nefarious relationships both with the army. And of course, more publicly, they've had that and probably maybe a bit of a stronger relationship with Hemeti.
Hemeti is the nickname for Dagalo.
Yeah, exactly. At this point, what's taking place in Sudan is foremost an internal power struggle between two hungry warlords. That said, there is still talks on the Libyan front about whether or not there might be mercenaries that could be mobilized, not Wagner, but mobilized from perhaps east to Libya. These reports are unconfirmed, but it is something to look out to. And the reason why that's important is because there is a bit of that friendly Wagner and Russian connection between particularly Darfur, which is the stronghold of the rapid support forces.
I didn't even mention China's investments in Sudan, some $6 billion in loan, Matt. There are many global powers that have something at stake in Sudan. The various parties that we've been discussing, are they likely to rein in the generals or let the fighting continue?
The first issue is, can the generals rein in their own forces? You know, I think we have to ask about the command and control structure here. Assuming that they're able to even do that, then I think we get into more the international spheres. If there is some glimmer of optimism here, I think perhaps the Security Council, as it pertains to Sudan, is not as divided as it has been generally on a number of other recent conflicts, obviously Ukraine, obviously Syria. And a part of that is for the reasons that you've just stressed. I think China has a lot of investments, but not just in Sudan, really. I think China's investments are really within its Belt Road initiative. It would like to see a conflict contained. I don't think it sees the upending of a region as particularly within its broader geopolitical interests, particularly a region as important as the Horn of Africa. So there should be some common incentive here, I think, between even rival powers in order to act quick and swiftly to contain this. And what does containment mean? Containment has to be humanitarian corridors, protection of civilians, and to ensure that parties are not violating laws of war without any consequences whatsoever, which is what brought us to this point to begin with, particularly the West wanting to hold the hands of these generals, thinking that they could be reformers one day without actually ever taking punitive measures. And of course, that has emboldened them to the very point where they feel that they can topple one another and then still be seen as a credible party in the eyes of the West.
Journalist Matt Nashed joined us from the Egyptian capital, Cairo, speaking about the financial backers of the rival generals at war in Sudan. Matt, really good to speak with you. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Likewise. Take care.
Keep up with our Sudan reporting at theworld.org and join us tomorrow for a look at how doctors are coping with medical crises in the conflict. The death in 2020 of soccer legend Diego Maradona sent Argentina into mourning. Now his medical team will face homicide charges. That story's ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. This week, Iraq suddenly closed a camp near Mosul that had been housing people who'd been forced out of their homes years ago during the country's fight against ISIS. Iraqi officials say closing the camp is a step towards ending displacement in the country, where more than 1 million Iraqis are still not back in the homes they left nearly 6 years after ISIS was defeated. The UN has criticized the camp's closure, saying it came too suddenly and that the people who lived there were unprepared. Journalist Yasmin Mossaman has been reporting from northern Iraq on what's going on at the camp. Yasmin, tell us about the people, first of all, living in this camp. Who are they?
So there were almost 1,600 people living in Jeddah camp, which is one of the last displacement camps in areas controlled by the federal government. You know, these people have been living in camps largely since the defeat of ISIS in 2017, and many are perceived to be linked to the group. So this doesn't necessarily mean that they're accused of being members of the terrorist group. And in fact, the UN says 2/3 of them are children. But what it does mean is that they often have a family member either known to or believed to have joined ISIS, and now are heavily stigmatized by society for it and find it difficult to return home.
Now, the UN says the closure of this camp was hasty and unplanned. How did authorities go about it?
You know, the UN and NGOs were initially told that they had until late May to leave the camp. But people say that on Monday, government officials and security officials announced that they just had 2 days to leave. So employees began confiscating the ID documents of residents in an attempt to pressure them to leave, saying that they could only have them back when they were off the premises. And, you know, overnight, the army had moved in. And the following day, the aid workers who arrived to the camp to oversee the process said they were locked out of the camp and weren't allowed to enter. And this is not the first time such a rushed procedure has happened. You know, in late 2020, rights groups and NGOs operating here criticized the government for suddenly announcing the closure of several camps. You know, the government has said it's pushing to end displacement in the country, but it has many wondering at what cost.
I mean, it sounds pretty chaotic. What's happened to these families? Where have they gone?
Aid workers have been trying to keep in touch with the families and have been only able to reach some of them. So they don't know the full picture of where they are and what they need in this really vulnerable situation. Some say they've been able to move in with family temporarily, but others who took their tents with them from the camp have just pitched them in places that aren't necessarily meant to house people. So it'll take a while to see the precise consequences of this closure. You know, in the past, we've seen families with a similar background, you know, manage to negotiate for a peaceful return to their home communities, but only time will tell for these families.
Yasmin, what are conditions like at these camps, these IDP camps, like Camp Jeddah?
I've reported from several of these camps over the years. You know, oftentimes it's women living with their children and other female relatives in very cramped conditions, living in tents with just really the bare necessities. And oftentimes their needs are really often met by UN and NGO aid. And many of them say that they've stayed in these camps because it's really the only way for them to survive.
Why have these families found it so hard to return to the places they came from?
It's for a whole wide range of reasons. You know, many are returning to villages and communities that still really are haunted by the violence perpetrated by ISIS and don't want people who were affiliated by the group to return. And others, you know, can't pass checkpoints because militias perceive them as associated with ISIS. And then there are others who simply don't have a place to return to. You know, these families have had their houses blown up. And others say they don't necessarily know that they could survive outside of the camps.
Yasmin Musliman is a reporter based in Baghdad telling us about the sudden closure of an internally displaced persons camp outside of Mosul in Iraq. Yasmin, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Argentina is fresh off its victory at the FIFA World Cup, but while the country celebrates Lionel Messi for his heroics in Qatar, they are also still carrying a torch for the late soccer legend Diego Maradona. Maradona died in 2020 from a heart attack, and this week in Argentina, a court ruled that 8 members of his medical team must stand trial for his death. Marcela Mora y Araujo is an Argentine journalist covering all things Diego Maradona and joins us from London. So, Marcelo, one of the greatest soccer players ever, and now what seemed to be the cause, a heart attack, might not be so straightforward. What do we know about Maradona's death? What did his last hours look like?
So we do know that they were lonely and slightly sordid, and he was in accommodation in a rented villa, which was by no means a kind of medically sound environment. He had undergone brain surgery a couple of weeks before his death and was discharged by the hospital. And he was taken to his private home where he was looked after by this team of people, and by all accounts was often undergoing, you know, long periods of time without eating or without drinking, or sometimes even worse, drinking alcohol that some people provided him or mixing alcohol with medication. And there seems to have been very little proper medical supervision.
What exactly is his medical team accused of?
the charge, what has happened this week is basically that the judges have accepted the accusation of homicide. So this is very significant because to some extent, a medical malpraxis or an involuntary manslaughter or you know, homicide without intention would carry a shorter sentence if found guilty. But they have accepted on the basis, I think there's hundreds of pages of documents submitted, that the medical team knew what the potential consequences of this would be. They will appeal this, and the trial isn't due to start till the end of 2024 or beginning of 2025 anyway, so we probably will have more twists and turns.
Marcella, who brought these charges?
So the prosecutors brought the charges. The investigation, which his daughters wanted and one of his ex-partners wanted and the people of Argentina want very much. The popular sense that somebody ought to be responsible is very big. And one of the challenges when it does come to trial will be for the court to manage to steer clear of this, you know, huge desire of the people to, you know, somehow excuse or find culpability in his death and just analyze the evidence purely on its own merits. It'll be very tough because the collective psyche of Argentina is in love with him.
So, yeah, put the gossip pages aside for a moment. How does Argentina remember Diego Maradona today? And how do you think the trial could impact his legacy?
I don't think the trial will impact his legacy at all, because I think Diego Maradona gave us enough years post his playing years to forge an actual persona that everyone became familiar with. There's very little that we don't know about him. There's very little new scandal that could shock or alter that. It's not like he has some kind of sanctity status that could be marred. You know, all the dirt has been thrown out already, and that was while he was alive.
Marcella Mora y Araujo is an Argentine sports writer and journalist with a focus on Diego Maradona. She joined us from London. Marcella, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with more news for you in a moment. You're listening to The World. Coming up, special greenhouses in India offer one solution to climate change. We also hear about the odd case of a missing signature.
Somebody has gone through so much trouble to create this wonderful work of art, to even inscribe poetry on it. Why didn't the artist sign it?
We'll get to the bottom of that and other stories still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. If you've listened to our show for a while, you'll remember this.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
You hear that, and you know it's time for The Big Fix, our series on climate solutions around the world. Today, we are relaunching The Big Fix with our environment editor, Carolyn Beeler, who joins me.
Marco, I am super stoked to be here. The importance of taking action on climate change has never been clearer, and the options to tackle it are more accessible than ever. So it's a perfect time to be talking about solutions.
Yeah, well, if report after report have not made it clear, remind us why now is such an important moment, that urgency that you're talking about.
Yeah, we talk about deadlines for action a lot, but like the bottom line is that despite everything we've learned about the perils of climate change over the last 30 plus years, emissions of planet warming pollution are still rising every year. And that has to change if we want to limit catastrophic heat waves, water shortages, storms. Everything we know is coming as the world warms.
Now, Carolyn, you say the solutions to climate change are more accessible than ever. Give us an example.
So here's a big one, Marco. Wind and solar power are the two technologies that single-handedly, or I guess maybe double-handedly, have the biggest potential to cut emissions over the next several years. And they have become much more affordable. Prices for solar, for example, have come down more than 80% in the last decade or so. And there are other important approaches to cutting emissions that we already know how to do, like stopping the destruction of forests and upping energy efficiency.
Big Fix stories will focus on solutions, but you're also going to take us places. Where are we going in this series?
We will head to the Brazilian Amazon for a story on new forest and mangrove conservation efforts. We'll also head to Spain to look at one of the biggest hurdles to increasing renewable energy deployment, which is that a lot of people agree that there need to be more wind and solar panels, but not everybody agrees on where those should be placed. So we'll hear from people like this activist in southern Spain who's arguing that old olive orchards should not be replaced by solar panels. And in addition to reporting on how to cut greenhouse gases, we will also be hearing about successful ways that people are adapting to climate change.
Yeah, stories like what?
We have one coming up about farmers in Mexico moving away from monocropping to cultivate a variety of crops in a more drought-resistant way.
La intención de crear un espacio así es como poder decir, oye,
this is one farmer saying they want to show there are different ways to do things. And it's not just humans adapting to climate change. We'll look at how animals are as well. With a story soon that touches on changing migration patterns for these guys, barnacle geese in the Arctic, and also the limits of adaptation for animals.
And today, to kick things off, we've got a solution story about small farmers in India.
That's right. Climate change is making summers hotter, rainfall less predictable, storms more intense. So protecting from these impacts is one way to help farmers adapt to a warming world. And in India, that's exactly what one nonprofit is doing with inexpensive, pared-down greenhouses for small farmers, which make up the majority of growers there.
The World's Environment editor, Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much for the preview. Here now is reporter Sushmita Pathak in southern India.
It's a windy day at Syed Sajjad Ali's farm in the southern Indian state of Telangana. In a small patch of land, about one-eighth of an acre, there are rows and rows of vines with bunches of juicy greenish-red tomatoes. The crops are inside a greenhouse.
This is protected from the sun, protected from the rain, it is protected from insects.
But this is no ordinary greenhouse. It's a low-cost, scaled-down version of a standard greenhouse made specifically for small farmers and is the brainchild of an Indian startup called Kheti. It all started some 10 years ago when Kheti's co-founders were trying to figure out what Indian farmers were struggling with the most. Here's co-founder Soumya, who goes by one name.
And that's when we started talking to like hundreds of farmers across the country, and all of them said something that was related to climate change.
So Soumya and her colleagues decided to work on something that would help make farmers more resilient to climate change.
We looked at a bunch of things. We looked at insurance. We looked at different seeds. We also came across the greenhouse, which had been around for, you know, many centuries.
Greenhouses help crops grow more efficiently by maintaining a controlled temperature and humidity environment. They also protect crops from pests and unpredictable weather. But in India, only rich farmers can afford greenhouses. They also don't come in small sizes. So Soumya and her colleagues decided to make a much smaller, more affordable greenhouse.
Get rid of a lot of these excess features that they make for big greenhouses, like the height. Like usually you'll see greenhouses are very big, very tall, reinforced with a lot of steel. So we said, okay, can we remove this? Can we remove this? And it was kind of like that whole like negotiation where we said, okay, what is the bare minimum covered structure that we can make? That was the approach.
Along with the greenhouse, Kheti also provides farmers with seeds, fertilizers, drip irrigation system, and installation help. Kheti's experts also advise and train farmers.
Because small farmers, again, they don't have market access, they don't know what inputs to buy. So then we said, okay, we'll bundle services with the product, and that's why we called it the greenhouse in a box.
Last year, Kheti's greenhouse in a box was among the winners of the Earthshot Prize that honors environmental solutions. So far, about 1,000 farmers across India have signed up for it. Syed Sajjad Ali got his greenhouse 7 months ago, and he's already seeing the results.
The size of tomato and the quality of tomato is much better than open field. Buyers very quickly take my tomatoes because they like this one.
Everyone wants your tomatoes.
Wants tomatoes like this.
But no one seems to want Renuka's tomatoes, growing just a few miles away. They're smaller. She planted them in an open patch, not in a greenhouse. For several weeks now, the going rate for tomatoes at her local village market has been a paltry 5 rupees or around 6 cents per kilo. Factoring in transport and labor costs, she will make a loss selling at those prices. So she's leaving them in the field to rot. Water wasted, fertilizer wasted, seedlings wasted. I get angry when I look at this, she says. Kheti's greenhouse can help farmers get higher prices by allowing them to grow in the off-season, when most people are not growing and the supply is low. A few years ago, Renuka saw a kheti greenhouse at a relative's farm and decided to get one herself. She used up a chunk of her savings, buying it for around $600, and planted cucumbers in it. It is too hot to grow cucumbers in the open, she says. But in the greenhouse, she got a pretty good harvest. Cucumbers sell for higher prices than the vegetables she usually grows. And over two crop cycles, she says she's almost recovered her investment. Next time, she hopes to make her first profit.
I think we need more and more greenhouses. There is no doubt about it.
Anjani Kumar is with the International Food Policy Research Institute in New Delhi. He says the small greenhouse is a good idea, but it is only suitable for farmers who grow fruits and vegetables. Others may have to take up poultry or livestock to supplement their incomes. As the climate changes, the government should also promote professions other than agriculture in rural areas, he says.
So that they can work in the farm, they can work off the farm, and combined they can have better income.
Whatever the solution, Kumar says government policies must take into consideration the needs of smallhold farmers.
They are going to be the most significant part for the foreseeable future for Indian agriculture.
And Kheti wants to make these small farmers climate smart. Over the next couple of years, the startup plans to get its greenhouses to 10,000 farmers. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Telangana, India.
Ever since that February spy balloon incident, tensions between the U.S. and China have been under a spotlight. In a speech today, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen tried to clarify where the Biden administration stands in terms of economic relations with Beijing. The message? They need us and we need them.
We know that the health of the Chinese and U.S. economies is closely linked. The United States does not seek competition that is winner-take-all. Instead, we believe that healthy economic competition with a fair set of rules can benefit both countries over time.
Yellen then elaborated on what that fair set of rules is. She said the Biden administration would continue to call out China about unfair trade practices that favored Chinese companies as well as human rights, like the country's dealings with Hong Kong and the Uyghurs in western China. One thing she did not mention was Taiwan. Yellen was speaking at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. In her remarks, the Treasury Secretary also defended targeted actions directed at Beijing. That included protecting certain technologies from getting into China based on U.S. national security concerns.
The United States will assert ourselves when our vital interests are at stake, but we do not seek to decouple our economy from China's. A full separation of our economies would be disastrous for both countries. It would be destabilizing for the rest of the world.
Treasury Secretary Yellen also brought up Ukraine. She said ending Russia's war, as she called it, would be the single best thing we could do for the global economy. She then made a pointed reference to Beijing's so-called No Limits partnership with Moscow, which it announced 20 days before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Yellen made it clear that there must be at least one limit to that relationship.
It is essential that China and other countries do not provide Russia with material support or assistance with sanctions evasion. We will continue to make the position of the United States extremely clear to Beijing and companies in its jurisdiction. The consequences of any violations would be severe.
That said, Yellen concluded her speech with this thought about China and the U.S. We believe that the world is big enough for both of us. We need to find a way to live together and live in prosperity. Saudi Arabia announced today that tomorrow will be the end of the holy month of Ramadan. The holiday of Eid is announced after the sighting of a new moon. In Canada, the Postal Service releases a stamp each year in celebration of Ramadan. This year's stamp was released earlier this month, and the image caught the attention of the world's Shirin Jafari. So she looked into the story behind it and what it takes to get a stamp like this printed.
The star of the show is a bowl from 700 years ago, made in Iran.
It could have held either dates, you know, as you break your fast, but it could have also equally held a soup or a stew.
Fahmida Soleiman is the curator of the Islamic World Collections at the Royal Ontario Museum, which owns the medieval bowl. She says it takes 2 years to design one of these stamps. Solomon picked this artifact because she says people used it during Ramadan, but also because of its elegant colors and design.
It's a lovely white glaze, but then it has a beautiful blue, sort of cobalt blue and black stripes.
Inside the bowl, in between geometric patterns and flowers, there are handwritten poems in Persian.
It talks about wisdom and intellect, but it also talks about, at this moment, you know, forget the sorrows of your world, of the world, and whatever your appetite draws you towards that food, may you enjoy it.
The bowl would have been expensive to make, Solomon says. Most Islamic pottery from the medieval period are unglazed, whereas this one is made from a special material called stone paste. It was invented to imitate Chinese porcelain.
Because everybody in the Middle East loved Chinese porcelain.
But they couldn't copy them because in Iran, they didn't have the special kind of clay that was needed. Instead, they mixed quartz, glass, and clay together to create a hard, white ceramic body.
So that is expensive in itself. Then you make the bowl and then you paint it, hand paint it, with a poem. You know, so someone literate had to write that poem. Somebody else had the design sense. And then you glaze it.
So she thinks it's the kind of object the owner would have displayed in their home when not using it. But there's a mystery.
Somebody has gone through so much trouble to create this wonderful work of art, to even inscribe poetry on it. Why didn't the artist sign it?
There is no artist's signature, at least as far as Solomon can tell. She wonders if there's a code somewhere buried in the patterns, maybe a puzzle. She hopes as the stamp gets more attention, people go on the museum's website, search for the bowl, and take a closer look for themselves. You can also see pictures of the stamp on our website. Bronwyn Graves is the director of stamp services at Canada Post. She says this year's Eid stamp was a bit of a departure from previous designs.
This is the first time we've featured an artifact on the stamp. In previous years, it's been more of an abstract design, so in many cases, it's stylized Arabic text.
In addition to the bowl, this year's stamp also features Islamic patterns. Those were the work of artist Uneyza Karim. Her challenge, to come up with a design that complements the bowl and fits in a super tiny space.
I was creating this pattern at the very top of the stamp, and this stamp needed to contain all these other things. You know, it needed to contain the calligraphy, the image of the bowl as well.
Countless drawings later, and after many trials and errors, Karim and the team came up with the final design. Since it came out earlier this month, Karim says she has been hearing from friends and people in her community.
Somebody messaged me and they said they don't actually use stamps. So many people don't use stamps anymore. But there's droves of people going out there buying it because it's an Eid stamp and they find it beautiful and they love the story that goes along with it.
The design for next year's stamp is well underway. Fahmida Soliman of the Royal Ontario Museum shared a sneak preview.
It's related to a special delicious pastry that many people in the Middle East eat. So that's all I'm going to say. It's because, you know, I want you to come back. I want to speak to you again next year.
A special pastry. I think I know which one. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Waiting a year for a stamp reveal requires a little patience. Speaking of patience, check this out. Today in the southern skies, there was a special kind of eclipse that will happen only 7 times this whole century. In this video from Indonesia, a crowd of people on a beach watch the moon creep in front of the sun. As it does, the sun looks almost like it's flickering out like a tired light bulb. This is called a hybrid eclipse. The entire sun was blocked out by the moon, but depending where on Earth you were to view the event, and because of where the moon is in the sky right now, a ring of sunlight was still visible around it. People could see that in Indonesia, East Timor, a bit in the Philippines. The coastal town of Exmouth on the west coast of Australia was one of the choicest spots for hybrid eclipse watchers.
Oh, wow, that is cool.
That is incredible.
Oh, look at that. Excitement ripples through the crowd in this video. Expressions both joyful and crude. It wasn't a good view in all of Australia, as one astrophotographer lamented in a video pointed up at a grey, overcast sky.
2023 solar eclipse from the eastern states of Australia. Son of a b-.
There will be 224 eclipses this century, and little more than a handful will be this hybrid kind. The next hybrid eclipse is expected on November 14th, 2031. Costa Rica, Nicaragua, and Panama should be great places to watch if you want to book your plane tickets early. A couple of stories now about international crime rings that have been taken down in dramatic busts, one in Europe and the other in the Americas. The first is mind-boggling in scale. It was carried out by the international police organization Interpol in Central and South America. Authorities seized thousands of guns and illegal drugs worth billions of dollars. They also arrested more than 14,000 people, all in the span of 3 weeks. The World's TBSi Zaya has our report.
It's called Trigger 9, and it's the biggest firearms operation ever conducted by Interpol in Latin America. In just 3 weeks, between March and April, authorities seized more than 8,000 illicit firearms, thanks to the cooperation of 15 countries.
I have not seen that before.
John Lindsay Poland is an expert on gun trafficking in Latin America and coordinates the Stop U.S. Arms to Mexico project. He says there is a massive influx of illegal arms causing a lot of violence in Latin America because they give power to criminal organizations.
So the more firepower they have, the more, for example, they can dictate to terms to law enforcement or local elected leaders or other economic elites. Or they can dictate terms to local small business people who are extorted by them, or people who are fleeing the violence that is created by those very organizations.
It's not clear where the arms are coming from in the case of every country, but more than half of the guns used to commit crimes in Central America and the Caribbean come from the U.S., according to the U.S. Gun Control Agency, ATF. And those guns end up in the hands of drug cartels.
Organizations that are producing fentanyl and making money from it and trafficking it to the United States are empowered by firearms that are coming from the United States.
It's estimated that 250,000 arms are trafficked from the U.S. into Mexico every year. Ana Yance Espinoza is a security expert with the Arias Foundation for Peace and Human Progress in Costa Rica.
Armas y droga van de la mano siempre.
She says the same routes used by criminal gangs to transport drugs to the north are used to bring guns to the south, as well as traffic people, animals, or chemicals used in illegal mining.
Pero hay muchos más armamentos que están pasando por fronteras terrestres.
Espinoza says many illegal arms are carried by single individuals across borders, but others arrive by mail. John Lindsay Poland says the biggest obstacle to fighting gun trafficking in the Americas is corruption.
There is, in many places, not an interest in going after firearms because state forces may be involved in the trafficking of the firearms.
He says many times military and police forces import arms legally into the region, but they end up in the hands of criminal gangs. He says operations like the one conducted by Interpol are important, but arrests and seizures are not enough.
We really have to address state policies, right, with government policies.
He's been advocating for a bill called the Armas Act, which will be reintroduced in the U.S. Congress in the coming days. It would create an interagency strategy against firearms trafficking to Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean.
And will also require controls to identify who are the end users of firearms that are legally exported from the United States to the region.
He adds that governments and agencies in the region should find ways to work collaboratively to fight the illegal trafficking of firearms. For the World, I'm TBSi Zea.
From a sprawling multi-country criminal bust to one targeting the operations of a single but massive lab. In Spain, police have taken down the largest cocaine laboratory ever found on European soil. Dozens have been arrested in an international sting operation involving cartels from Mexico and Colombia. The lab is in a remote region of Galicia in northwest Spain and was producing hundreds of pounds of cocaine per day. The lab itself represents a seismic shift in how Latin American drug rings are getting a foothold in Europe. Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
Dozens of Spanish police and drug enforcement officers swept into the remote Galician compound at dawn. Their rifles were raised, but they found only a handful of unarmed men outside an innocuous-looking warehouse.
Vivían en régimen de esclavitud, aislados totalmente del exterior, dedicados única y exclusivamente.
The workers we discovered there were living like slaves, said National Police Subcommander Emilio Rodriguez. He was speaking to the press after last week's bust. The men had no phones or passports, he said, and they weren't even allowed outside. We found them climbing out a window just to be able to smoke a cigarette. Inside the building, police found a state-of-the-art 24/7 coke lab. Bricks of product stamped with the symbol of a stallion lay about on scales. Blue and red plastic tubs still bubbled with chemicals. It's the biggest cocaine lab ever found in Europe, Spanish Police Drugs Commissioner Antonio Martinez told reporters. We frustrated an operation capable of making 500 pounds of cocaine per day. And, he said, we stopped them from dumping thousands of pounds of toxic chemical residue into a local river. The scale of the operation has surprised police and residents of Galicia, long accustomed to narco-trafficking in their backyards, or better put, along their coastal inlets. There are thousands of miles of waterways known as rías in Galicia, where for decades local smugglers snuck in everything from cigarettes to heroin. A hugely popular series on Spanish Netflix, Fariña, tells the story of the Galician clans who built empires smuggling cocaine beginning in the 1980s. Fernando Alonso is with the Galician Foundation Against Narco-Trafficking. It's an NGO that lobbies for tougher measures against the criminal groups. He says the shared Spanish language has long made Galician distributors and Latin American cocaine producers natural partners. But the recently discovered lab, it appears to have been 100% Latino-run, no Galician partners.
Forma parte de la lógica criminal y de sus ganas de expandirse y de diversificar las.
From a criminal point of view, it's logical, Alonso says. The cartels want to expand and diversify the way they produce and sell. They want their own foothold here, he says, because the European market is very attractive. Alonso says the Latin American cartels are betting that making the coke in Europe is less risky, as smuggling in the raw ingredients attracts less attention. It's also a lot cheaper.
Te ahorras más o menos un 30% de la carga, que es lo que pierden.
The cartels save around 30% per kilo of drugs this way, Alonso says. That's the amount they normally have to pay out to all the middlemen, the smugglers, etc., when they're moving the finished product itself. But Alonso says the Latino cartels haven't dropped traditional methods, smuggling via container ships, even submarines. And for that, they still need their Galician partners to ferry the goods to shore. But after last week's bust, Alonso suspects police will be finding more Latin American cocaine labs in Europe. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon in Barcelona.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nana Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks as always for listening.